ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about how a plant-based diet is healthy for humans and also the healthiest thing we can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about animals, stay tuned for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we have a conversation with Dr. Michael Greger of the Humane Society of the United States. But first, some news.
Wildlife activists are calling for an end to a high body count coyote killing contest in New Mexico that has no relation to hunting, involves no fair chase, and amounts to animal cruelty. Gunhawk Firearms, the second business to attempt to sponsor a contest hunt in New Mexico this year, charges $50 for an entry fee to all contestants and then will award them an assault rifle if they bring in the most coyote bodies during a two-day event in November. Gunhawk Firearms claims that killing coyotes will help ranchers and farmers. However, according to Wendy Kiefover, despite widespread disbelief, killing coyotes simply does not result in fewer coyotes. For decades, biologists have demonstrated through research that coyotes make up for their losses by changing their behaviors. Despite the war on coyotes that's been going on since the 1850s, coyotes' ranges have expanded threefold. They now roam east of the Missouri River, north into Canada, and south into Central America, even as they face a constant barrage of poisons, guns, traps, and aerial shooters directed at them. When their populations are exploited, more females breed, litter sizes grow, and coyotes immigrate from other areas to fill any vacancies. Adaptable, they can live as solitary individuals, as mated pairs, or in packs. Coyotes actually benefit farmers and ranchers because they prey primarily on rodents and rabbits, which compete with livestock for forage or damage crops. Despite the pervasive myth, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has documented for decades that coyotes kill minuscule numbers of livestock and that most unintended causes of livestock mortality come from disease, birthing problems, and inclement weather, including drought. Mary Catherine Ray of the Rio Grande chapter of the Sierra Club stated, "Contest hunts raise alarming ethical and conservation for all New Mexicans. Mindless, random, body count killing contests benefit neither nature nor livestock owners. They serve only to feed human bloodlust and ego."
Fish provides omega-3 fatty acids, which may potentially help dementia like Alzheimer's disease. But some researchers show concern about the safety of farmed fish because the fish may acquire infectious prions from cows with mad cow disease, also known as bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Humans who eat the infected fish may contract the human version of mad cow disease called variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Robert Friedland of the Department of Neurology at the University of Louisville School of Medicine in Kentucky published a report in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease to express the concern about infectious prions. Fish consumption is widely recommended because it's believed that the omega-3 fatty acids in fish may help reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. The American Heart Association recommends 2 servings of fish per week. The researchers said in their report, "We are concerned that consumption of farmed fish may provide a means of transmission of infectious prions from cows with mad cow disease." In addition to fish, a new study in the Journal of Virology suggests that milk from animals with brain-wasting disease may carry infectious prions, meaning that drinking tainted milk or dairy products may give the consumers the human version of mad cow disease. Milk has never been tested for the prions. And the pasteurization process to sterilize milk does not kill infectious prions. Fish varies in the amount of omega-3 fatty acids they contain. And along with the omega-3, we get a dose of mercury, PCBs, and DDT. The USDA suggests only 2 servings of fish a week, and that pregnant women should limit themselves to 2 servings a month because of the mercury and other contaminants. The Institute of Medicine recommends 1.5 grams of omega-3 per day for men and 1 gram a day for women. You would have to eat 1.5 servings of salmon a day to get that. It's much safer to skip the fish and the contaminants and get omega-3 from flaxseed, walnuts, or vegetable supplements of omega-3.
KUMN.org reports that rare fish are not faring well in the Rio Grande. The Rio Grande in Las Lunas has been exceptionally dry. Mike Hatch of the U.S. government's Rivers Eyes program has been tracking the status of the water in the Rio Grande. The worst day this year was August 14th, when 53 miles of the river ran dry. It has happened before, and 2012 wasn't the worst year. In 2003, 60 miles dried, and in 2004, almost 70 miles. The past 24 months have been the driest on record, that is, since at least 1900. As part of the River's Eye program, Hatch is checking the riverbed each morning because of a 4-inch-long fish, the silvery minnow. The fish used to swim almost the entire length of the Rio Grande. Now it has about 150 miles of habitat in the middle Rio Grande. But long stretches of the fish's habitat keep running dry during the irrigation season when river water is diverted into canals. There's one important stretch that can't dry, however. In 1994, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the silvery minnow for protection under the Endangered Species Act. Then, 10 years ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service required water managers to keep water flowing through Albuquerque for the minnow. The fish is doing poorly this year. That's despite biologists rescuing minnows in the summer and the more than $150 million spent by the Middle Rio Grande Endangered Species Act Collaborative Program over the past decade. Population surveys in September indicate the lowest number of silvery minnows since 1993. By mid-September, it was evident that we were having historic low numbers for the minnow. And in a survey in October, they found not one minnow in the Middle Rio Grande. In almost 20 years, that's the first.
Dr. Michael Greger is Director of Public Health and Animal Agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States. Dr. Greger is an expert on vegan nutrition and posts a new short video on nutrition every day at his website, nutritionfacts.org. Stay with us. Michael Greger comes up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio, Dr. Michael Greger. Michael, thanks for being with us on the last show of our 10th year of ACT Radio.
I am honored.
Michael, can we get started by having you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in animal issues and veganism?
Oh, my story really goes back to my childhood when my grandmother was cured of terminal heart disease by Nathan Pritikin, one of the early lifestyle medicine pioneers with a plant-based diet. She was basically sent home to die at age 65. She had so many bypass graft operations, so much open-heart surgery that basically, you know, they kind of ran out of plumbing. She was confined to a wheelchair because she had such bad peripheral circulation, crushing chest pain. But, you know, she went to one of these kind of, you know, Pritikin centers where you go in, they teach you how to cook, put you on a healthy diet. And she was wheeled in, and she walked out. And within a few weeks, she was walking 10 miles a day, and she went on to live another 31 years on this planet with her 6 grandkids, including me. And so that's really what kind of started my whole life path towards medicine. But actually, my own diet didn't change until 1990 when Dr. Ornish published his landmark work showing that we cannot just slow down the heart disease or prevent heart disease, stop it in its tracks, but actually reverse heart disease, open up arteries without drugs, without surgery, with just a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle changes. And so, you know, that's our number one killer. And so look, I mean, if that's the only thing a vegan diet could do is reverse the number one cause of death for men and women, well, then what else do you need to know about a diet? I mean, that should be the default, right, until proven otherwise. And the fact that it also helps may play a role in helping prevent 15 out of our top 16 killers in the United States is just kind of icing on the cake. Vegan icing on the cake.
Well, I think I've also seen that it could reverse cancer. Is that going too far?
Well, not for prostate cancer. So, you know, Ornish, after having, you know, conquered our number one killer, said, all right, and went on to killer number two, which was cancer. Now, there's only really two scenarios in which you can attempt lifestyle changes for cancer, either very early on in the disease or very late on the disease. Kind of in the middle of the disease, it's considered unethical to try anything but conventional kind of chemosurgery, radiation. But very early on in slow-growing cancer, such as prostate cancer, a legitimate strategy is kind of a watch and wait. And there's a cancer biomarker called a PSA, which tracks very well along with cancer growth. And so you can keep an eye on the cancer non-invasively by getting a serial blood test. And so then you can wait to have your prostate removed, which can have all sorts of adverse consequences like impotence and urinary incontinence. So you wait to the last moment when the cancer really starts growing, and then you can just take the prostate out. And so in that early stages, they're basically not doing anything for you but watching and waiting. So, hey, why not give diet a try? And the other scenario is in terminal cancer when there's absolutely nothing conventional medicine has to offer, and in which case, well, might as well try a lifestyle intervention. So that's been tried as well, and I have some videos coming out on that. But in terms of the first scenario in prostate cancer, that's what Ornish did. They had men in that early stage of prostate cancer, and within a year of a plant-based diet, showed that they were actually able to reverse the cancer biomarker, reverse PSA, instead of not just slowing down cancer growth, not just kind of a plateauing of PSA levels, but actually reversal, actually went down. So the control group that did nothing, well, it went up, 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 and a few had to actually go into surgery. They couldn't even complete the study. But the plant-based diet group, on average, actually reversed. So that shows that the cancer was actually shrinking, was going backwards. And that's the first time we've ever seen cancer reversal with dietary changes. And again, it was a plant-based diet. So that's killer number one, killer number two, and killer number three used to be stroke, but that was back in 2011. Now it's COPD, and we can even improve lung function by giving people more plants in their diet. So there's a very powerful argument to be made, a very selfish argument. I mean, some people eat this way to help the environment, for animals, but even if you just care about not the lives of animals, but just the life of one animal, yourself, or even, you know, even if you don't care about the environment, but just want to see your grandkids grow up, well, then this is appears to be the way to eat.
When I went vegetarian 34 years ago, it was for animal reasons, and along the way, the environmental reasons became important. And now that I'm in my 60s, the health reasons are really growing in importance.
Yeah, great.
So let's talk about what are the best foods of a plant-based diet that will increase our chances of not getting disease?
Well, the healthiest plant foods, most importantly, is unprocessed plant foods, so whole plant foods. So that's fruits, vegetables, legumes, beans, peas, lentils, soy, as well as whole grains, nuts, seeds, mushrooms, spices. But, you know, within those categories, the healthiest vegetable are the dark green leafy vegetables. The healthiest fruits are the berries. So I encourage people to eat berries every day. Eat dark green leafy vegetables every day. We're finding more and more wonderful things about beans. So I encourage people to eat beans every day or even a couple times a day. Really some of the most kind of, in terms of power-packed, kind of nutrition-packed foods for the amount of calories, it's really hard to beat foods like beans and greens.
Michael, can you tell us a little bit about some of the foods that extend life?
Yeah, well, the Harvard Nurses Study, just the 35-year follow-up was just published last year, involved more than 100,000 women, so really is the most definitive long-term study ever on older women's health. Unfortunately, in that time, you know, thousands of women died. It was a long study, but that enabled them to kind of determine the risk factors for mortality because, of course, number one cause of death was heart disease. No surprise that cholesterol consumption, dietary cholesterol, was found to be a significant risk factor for death. And the second leading cause was smoking-related cancer deaths. And they were actually able to do these kind of statistical analyses to compare the two. And it turns out that consuming the amount of cholesterol found in just a single egg a day appears to cut a woman's life short as much as smoking 5 cigarettes a day for 15 years. And the most protective behavior they found was fiber consumption. So eating just, for example, a cup of oatmeal's worth of fiber a day appears to extend one's life as much as jogging 4 hours a week. Of course, there's no reason you can't do both, though. But it's instructive to note that, look, the intake of cholesterol only found in animal foods was significantly associated with living a shorter life, and the intake of fiber only found in plant foods was significantly associated with living longer. And the one fiber-containing food that appeared to extend women's life the most was nuts. Just 2 handfuls of nuts a week was associated with that same 4 hours of weekly jogging benefit.
Michael, can you tell us a little bit about the research? It seems like people on both sides of the camp try to use scientific research to put forward their diets. You know, you see all kinds of scientific evidence supporting, you know, all these fad diets that come out. So how do we know which evidence to trust or to believe?
Well, so all we can do is we can make decisions on the best available evidence. And in circumstances in which there's evidence suggesting 2 different options, then all we can do is rely on the balance of evidence. You know, one of the videos on nutritionfacts.org, I talk about soy foods and menopausal symptoms like hot flashes. And you'll see, you know, in the news, something come out and say soy helps, with hot flashes. Another one comes out and says soy doesn't help with hot flashes. And it depends whether they're actually eating soy foods or they're just taking the soy isoflavone supplements. You know, so I go through and I just show, so they do these kind of so-called meta-analyses where they look all the studies, put them all together, and they see kind of on average or on balance, what does the best available science show? And in that case, it showed indeed, I forget the breakdown of studies, but it showed indeed that it does appear to help. So that's really the best we can do. And so when any of these kind of controversial things come up, you just look at the best available evidence, which is what's most current. Where can you find that? NutritionFacts.org.
Another related kind of question is, how do you respond to people that say, well, you know, I can eat whatever I want as long as I do it in moderation?
Well, can you smoke in moderation? I mean, when, you know, someone comes to me who's a, you know, 2-pack-a-day smoker, you know, what helps if they cut down a 0.5-pack a day? I mean, really, it does make a difference in terms of their, you know, the scarring that's going on in their lungs, the risk of lung cancer. And so that's great. So they're moderating their intake of cigarette smoke. Okay. But there's no reason one has to smoke. Well, there's no kind of beneficial reason one has to smoke. And so ideally, we just cut out completely. Similarly, you know, there's no reason we need to have any cholesterol in our diet. In fact, there does not seem to be a tolerable upper limit, meaning that any cholesterol in our diet causes bad effects. Same thing with saturated animal fat, same thing with trans fats, which can also be found in plant-based junk food and these hydrogenated oils. You know, so we should limit our intake of animal foods and junk foods as much as possible. It doesn't make sense to me that one would do something bad for them in moderation as that being superior in some way than
I think it's just
your choice.
I think it's just an excuse for them to continue their bad habits. Getting back to soy for a moment, someone asked me the other day about soy. She said her husband had concerns that soy would make him effeminate because of the phytoestrogens and he might grow breasts, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there's actually 2 different estrogen receptors. One is the one that deals with the feminizing aspects of estrogen. And the other one deals with some of these other kind of cancer-protective. And the phytoestrogens, the plant-based estrogens found in soy, predominantly affect only the non-feminizing estrogen receptors. And so that's why one can, you know, have kind of remarkably high soy consumption levels and not have, and just kind of have the beneficial effects of estrogen. For example, women live longer, they have lower risk of heart disease, even though it continues to be the number one killer of women. And so phytoestrogens for men can lower their risk of osteoporosis and improve their heart health and reduce their risk of prostate cancer without fear of feminization.
Well, and plus, aren't there cultures around the world that eat quite a bit of soy in their natural diet and you don't see them having these feminizing effects?
Sure, though, you know, so in China, maybe 5 grams of soy a day, they may average. Japan eats the most. But, you know, they're talking about 10 grams a day, maybe 2 servings of soy a day. you know, I think the concern was raised that now they have these like soy protein powders and soy isolates where you can have kind of levels of soy intake that you don't see kind of naturally around the world that haven't been, you know, eaten for hundreds of years. And so I do encourage people to limit their soy intake to under 5 servings a day. So that's 5 cups of soy milk or 5 servings of tofu or tempeh or whatever. That's probably a good idea just because we haven't seen, you know, they have these powerful medicinal effects and we just don't know the effects on higher doses on large populations.
Well, that seems like quite a bit of soy,
yeah.
Even for us vegans.
I think a lot of people, when they become vegetarian, they start taking the soy protein powders thinking, oh, I need a lot of protein now that I'm vegetarian.
Oh, but, yeah, unfortunately. I mean, but they should, as with almost all their nutrients, right, they should try to get from whole plant foods. Sure, you can get all the protein you want from protein powder, but you're missing out on all the wonderful things found in, for example, legumes, the plant protein superstars, right? I mean, yeah, you can get the protein. But beans also have the fiber and the folate and the phytonutrients and the potassium, all these other wonderful things we want in our bodies.
Well, coming up is a big holiday, a big food-centered holiday. So maybe we should talk just a little bit with our listeners about some reasons why turkey isn't one of the preferred foods for people to eat for their health.
Let's talk turkey. you know, there are certainly food safety concerns. And one thing that struck me recently. So just I've been doing this new video every day, and just last week I've been talking about industrial pollutants that build up in the food supply. So whether we're talking about these organochlorine pesticides or dioxins, PCBs, you kind of regularly, basically all the studies point to the same thing, and that many of these toxins are fat soluble, so they build up in the food chain. The worst is fish oil, which are kind of, you know, unfortunately, our oceans are kind of the sewers of humanity. Everything kind of flows down to the sea. So actually, it goes pet food, actually, is the most contaminated. So pet food and then fish, and then typically chicken, then lower pork, and then beef. So it's kind of this reversal of saturated fat, that where actually white meat is worse. But for the first time, they measured levels of these pollutants in turkey. And so just in one of the videos last flame retardant chemical pollutant video or the perfluoro chemical pollutant video. But one of the videos, it's still on the homepage now. So between fish and chicken, so more than chicken, so really the second leading source in our diet would be turkey. Now, of course, look, if you're only having it once a year, that's not as much of an issue, but it's certainly something that one would want to not eat regularly. And ideally, we want to eat as low as possible on the food chain, ideally a plant-based diet, and organic as much as possible.
I think I saw at your website something about staph infections from turkey.
Oh, yeah. So that's another. So it turns out that half of the meat supply, 49% of the meat supply in the country, is contaminated with these staphylococcal bacteria, many of which are antibiotic resistant because of the literally millions of pounds of antibiotics used just to make factory farm animals grow faster and prevent disease in such kind of a stressful, unhygienic environment. So when they looked to see kind of which was the worst, turkey actually had higher levels of staph bacteria than beef, chicken, or pork. So 3/4 of retail turkey was contaminated compared to lower levels found in these other meats. And so kind of odds are, you know, 3 out of 4, they're picking up staph-contaminated carcass in the store. Now, this bacteria, as all bacteria, can be utterly destroyed by proper cooking, but it's the handling. That's, mm-hmm. You know, because meat comes into one's home often fresh or frozen, you know, before, unless you can kind of levitate it into the oven, you know, before it makes it there. I mean, even if you're really careful, you know, have the meat thermometer and you're careful that the stuffing reaches a particular temperature, the concern is that, well, you know, in all that preparation process, you know, the problem is some of that juice, the kind of the fecal soup, you know, could cross-contaminate the counter, or kitchen utensils, or your hands, or drip on the floor, or someone could get infected that way. So we think cross-contamination is actually the reason why tens of millions of Americans every year fall ill with food poisoning from pathogens that are killed by cooking.
I had a question about, you know, we read a lot about arsenic levels in chickens. Is this also a concern in turkey?
The same arsenic-containing drugs that were fed to chickens were also fed to turkeys as well. In fact, we just found out how many. October 29th, Johns Hopkins School of Public Health released an analysis that FDA actually accidentally let it slip they've been refusing to tell anyone how much arsenic is being fed to poultry in this country for years. But they basically, a little detective work, found out, it looks like it's about 1.5 million pounds of arsenic-containing drugs fed to chickens and turkeys, predominantly in this country, or at least sold. So if this was 2010, the latest statistics, we have 1.5 million pounds sold to these meat producers, and presumably they use them all up. It's to pinken the meat. It kind of makes the meat a little pinker, and that's something that consumers will pay more money for, prefer. But the problem is that, you know, arsenic is consumption. Essentially, there's no safe level, just like some of these other toxic elements, such as lead and mercury. We really want to decrease our intake as much as possible.
So once again, everything in moderation doesn't apply with arsenic?
probably, right. Yeah, maybe less so arsenic than lead and mercury, but really, yeah. I mean, if you have two things in front of you, one has more arsenic, one has less arsenic, you choose the food with less arsenic. You know, all else being equal.
There was a recent Consumer Reports thing about arsenic in rice, and it was traced back to the fact that they use chicken manure as fertilizer.
Right. So why, right? Why is most of the arsenic in rice in Arkansas and Texas, some of these poultry-producing states? Well, that's what they think. And so actually, the rice industry is suing the poultry industry now.
Right.
you know, because they all have all this damage. They say, well, wait a second. You know, why should people be scared of our product just because you've been dumping arsenic onto our fields?
We should probably be a lot more worried about the levels in chicken if we eat chicken than the levels that are found in rice.
It wouldn't be a bad idea to go through that list and eat lower arsenic sources of rice and to diversify one's grains and, you know, discover some of these other wonderful grains people may not even know about, like quinoa.
Quinoa.
Where there's no quinoa fields are ever touched by arsenic-containing chicken manure.
Well, that sounds like a good addition to the vegan Thanksgiving feast.
That sounds fun, yeah. Cranberries in there. Mm.
We've been talking with Dr. Michael Greger, Director of Public Health and Animal Agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States. And he runs a great webpage filled with nutritional videos, short little videos that give you all kinds of information about what we should be eating. That's nutritionfacts.org. Michael, thanks so much for being with us on ACT Radio today.
So happy to be here, and what a great 10 years. Hopefully there'll be another 10 around the corner.
You're right. We'll see you in January, on January 12th, when you're guest speaker at the Vegetarian Society of El Paso.
I can't wait to come back.
If you'd like to learn more about a vegetarian or a vegan diet, you can visit the website of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. And if you're looking on the webpage, you'll notice that we're going to have a holiday dinner at the Opus World Bistro on December 6th. And Chef Michael Ross has a very delicious-sounding menu ready for us. Check it out at vsep.org.
If you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of Animal Concerns of Texas, you'll find them at ktep.org. Just click the Listen to Past Shows button. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.